It is time then for week 13 of Megillat Rut. As I said in the email when I sent out the source sheet, I decided that there's no way I'm squeezing chapter 4 into 1 week, and it's not fair to everybody who's been plugging away all along to not cover the end of the chapter. So what we're going to do is, my goal for today is to talk about the first half of the chapter, the transaction involving the field, involving marrying Ruth, Ploni Almoni, for some reason being known as Ploni Almoni, which, as we'll see, is not his real name. So that's what I want to talk about today. I think it ties into very important themes we've been developing all along. And then what I plan to do after that, at some point next week, depending on my travels, is to record a last session on Ruth, talking about the end of the chapter. So dealing with the question of the blessings that the women give to Boaz and maybe to Ruth also, the statement that Ruth is better for you, or someone is better for somebody than seven sons. The local women seeming to name the son of Ruth Obed. Why are the local women involved in giving a name? Some of these issues that come up there towards the end of the chapter are what I want to do in a recording, and that way we'll get through Ruth. And then July 6th we'll have a session on Echa, and it'll just be an overview basically of the book, and that way we did not lie when we put out a flyer saying that we had three Megillot. Okay. But let's begin. Oh, I do want to note, I'm going to send it out by email also, but I do want to make sure to note this Sunday, Shavuot Seba Tammuz, the fast of the 17th of Tammuz, if Mashiach has not arrived. If Mashiach does arrive, it's still the 17th of Tammuz. We're going to have a program for my Beit Midrash, a day of learning, 12 half-hour sessions about different aspects of fasting in Tanakh, starting at 10 a.m. and running through 4 p.m., we're going to be talking about some of the lesser-known fasts on the calendar. We're going to be talking about fasting in Tanakh. We'll have a few sessions on fasting in Jewish law, fasting for a nightmare, fasting while pregnant, all sorts of interesting things. I think they're interesting anyway, from a range of good speakers. So that's going to, and it's all free of charge. It's going to be on Sunday from 10 to 4. Hopefully it'll give us an opportunity to do something with the fast beyond, waiting to be able to eat. That would be the goal. So the sessions will be recorded, God willing, posted on YU Torah, possibly on our YouTube channel as well, depending on how we feel the sessions go. All right. So let's see what we can do here with chapter 4. If you have the source sheet, you see the outline right at the top. The chapter is going to begin with Boaz offering Ploni Almoni the right to redeem the field of Ruth / Naomi. We'll have to talk about what field it was exactly. And he's willing to do so. However, when it becomes a matter of marrying Ruth, he's interested. And so Boaz acquires the right to redeem as well as the right to marry Ruth. We get this nice blessing by the local population. Ruth and Boaz marry. They have a son named Obed, who is viewed as Naomi's son. And then we get the lineage of the Davidic dynasty. And those are the basic elements of the chapter. And really what's going to happen here is fundamentally Ruth and Boaz move the story forward at Naomi's initiative. That's really what this comes down to. And our story comes to a close. So there are so many questions that one could ask about this chapter, but we're gonna tackle, like I said in the beginning, what's the story is with this field, what's the story with marrying Ruth, why does redeeming the field require marrying Ruth, why is Ploni Almoni named Ploni Almoni, what is this? So we have to start by reading the opening six sentences of the chapter. So chapter 4, sentences 1 to 6. We are not going to understand everything about them right away, and that's fine. We may not understand them in an hour either. But we're going to do the best that we can with this, and you have to start by reading the psukim. So, chapter 4, sentence 1. Uvoaz Allah ha-sha'ar v'yeshev sham. Right? Naomi just said to Ruth, Boaz is going to take care of this today. He ain't waiting. Sure enough, Boaz goes right up to the gate and he sits there. We're not going to discuss right now, but those who have learned Tanakh in any measure know the gate is the place of convocation. It's where people get together. It's often where the judges are. It's often where messages are conveyed to the community as a whole. So Boaz goes to the city gate, Beit Lechem, and he sits there. And v'hinei ha-go'el over asher diber Boaz. Sure enough, this Redeemer who Boaz had talked about shows up there at the gate. There's a whole discussion in the Medrash, God making sure that he would show up there in order to enable this to happen. Vayomer sura shiva po ploni almoni. And Boaz says, leave your path. Sura is a term that we use to refer to straying. Where? Yeah, I know you're busy. I know you're headed off in that direction. Nonetheless, come on over here. Ploni almoni. Vayasar vayeshev. And he did. He went along with what Boaz told him to do. And that's a theme in this chapter in general. Everybody does what Boaz tells them to do. That's one of the pieces of evidence from the text itself that Boaz is a somebody. What he says goes. So he says, yeah, listen, I know you're busy today, but you're coming over here, and he comes over here. Vayikach asara anashim mizikne ha'ir. So he takes, Boaz takes 10 men, specifically from the elders of the city. And again, showing Boaz the status that he's able to marshal 10 of the city's elders. Vayomer shvufo, and he says, sit here. Vayeshevu. And they sat. Boaz tells you to sit, you sit. A lot to be said also about using elders specifically. In other words, anything that requires a quorum of 10, we don't specify you need 10 elders. Nonetheless, 10 elders will be useful for him here. We might come back to that, we might not. We'll see. There is stuff to be said about it for sure. Vayomer la goel. So Boaz says to the Redeemer, the portion of the field that our brother Elimelech had. And remember, we've talked about how the relationship works. And the Gemara's view of it seems to be that Elimelech and Ploni Almoni are brothers, and Boaz is a nephew of theirs. In which case, Achinu is the way Ach and Achod are often used in Tanakh. We sandwich generations. It doesn't mean biological siblings. It can include nephews, nieces, first cousins. That happens. So our brother, Elimelech, had this field. Machra Naomi. Now, there are two different ways you can translate the word machra, right? Either Naomi sold, or Naomi has decided to sell. Right? You follow me? Those of you who are working with an English translation, in sentence 3, when he identifies the field, does your translation say Naomi has sold it, or Naomi is selling it, or Naomi has decided to sell it? Yeah, Toby.
Offered for sale.
Offered for sale. Is selling, right. Okay, Susan, that's what you have also, I guess. Okay. Yeah, and the reason why no one takes it as Naomi has already sold it is because that would create a halachic problem. We're going to come back to what the halachic problem is because the Malbim is going to mention it. But basically,
Machra's in the past tense.
So that's what I'm trying to tell you. Machra doesn't have to be in the past tense. It can be she put it up for sale, in which case it is past tense, it's just that she put it up for sale, but it could also refer to someone who is selling. But the reason why we're insisting on that is because we have a general rule, which goes back to the Torah in the 25th chapter of Vayikra of Leviticus, Parshas Behar, in which we are told that if some family has an ancestral piece of land in Israel, and they sell it, the buyer automatically gets it for 2 years at the minimum. After that, they're entitled to demand the right to buy it back. But minimum 2 years for the person who sold it, because generally speaking, the only reason somebody would sell an ancestral field was poverty. So the buyer is viewed as somebody who is a Baal Chesed. They're being helpful by buying it. We don't want them to suffer laying out the money to buy it, and then a year later, after they've done work and planted and everything else, now suddenly you come back and say, I'd like my field back. So therefore, the rule is that you can't buy it back before 2 years have elapsed. Well, Naomi has only been back in town for the length of the wheat harvest, or barley harvest, or whatever harvest it is. She hasn't been back for 2 years. So if Naomi has sold the field, Ploni Almoni can't redeem it yet. So we're going to expand on that in a little bit. There are other reasons, other ways we know that she hasn't sold it yet. But the point is, she is selling it now, not that she has already sold the field. So Naomi, who came back from Moab, has this field. She's decided to sell. Pasuk Dalet, sentence 4. Va'ani amarti, Boaz says, I said, and you can just see him kind of stroking his beard there, like, I said, Egla oznecha lemor, I will open your ear, saying, Kne neged hayoshevim, v'neged zikne ami, you should acquire the field, opposite the residents of the town, in front of everybody at the gate, and opposite the elders of my nation, right? You notice that? This is, again, the possessive that Boaz has. Im tig'al ga'ol. If you're going to redeem the field, which is understood to be an act of kindness, right? I'm redeeming the field. I'm helping them out. If you're going to redeem it, good. V'im lo yig'al. However, Boaz turns to the other people at the gate. And if he won't redeem it, Hagidali, then tell me right now. Boaz turns, you see the change in the grammar, right? He doesn't say v'imlo tig'al, if you will not redeem it, but v'imlo yig'al, if he will not redeem it. Okay, then fine, Hagidali, tell me. I will know, ki ein zulas chalik ol, because there's nobody else to do the redeeming, v'anochi acharecha, I'm next. Vayomer, anochi egal. And he says, no problem. I'm happy to do it. I'm a good man, and I'm going to provide money, and I'll take the field. Then Boaz throws a wrench in it. It's very interesting. Dr. Ziegler makes a point of this, although she doesn't really do anything with it. Boaz is going about this the wrong way. Meaning, what's Boaz's mission on this day? What's his job?
To get Ruth married, right?
Either to marry Ruth or to get Ploni Almoni to marry Ruth. But somebody's got to marry Ruth today. So why is he talking about the field? He started the conversation with something that's completely irrelevant. Or should be.
He didn't want to go directly to the root of the matter.
So to speak.
He wanted to skirt around it.
But why? Like, what does he gain? It's really not clear in the story why he plays this game, talking about the field first. But it's not going to benefit him. It's very strange, but watch what happens now. Sentence 5. This is the switch part of the bait and switch. Okay? The bait was the field. Now comes the switch. Vayomer Boaz. Boaz says, by the way, Biyom kinoscha sadeh miyad la'ami. On the day that you acquire the field from Naomi, umei es rus ha-moaviyah, eshes ha-meis kanisa, and from Ruth the Moabite, in case you don't remember. Right? Because you haven't said it a dozen times in the book. From Ruth the Moabite, the wife of the one who died, you have transacted lahakim shem hameis al nachal aso, in order to maintain the name of the deceased on his portion. In other words, you're not just transacting with Naomi, you also have to transact with Ruth, and evidently, the grammar in this sentence is very difficult to work with, but the upshot of it is, you want to get the field, you also have to marry Ruth. That's part of the game. And at that point, Ploni Almoni says, I didn't understand that. Vayomer HaGoel, sentence 6, Lo uchal ligol li. He says, oh, I can't redeem. I can't redeem for me. For me, this is a bad idea. Pen ashchis es nachalasi. It would ruin my portion. Why don't you do the redeeming? I can't do it. It would ruin my portion. Now, we could spend the next 45 minutes asking questions about this story, but I'm going to make it easy. There are all sorts of things wrong with this picture. I still go back to the question of why Boaz started with the field. If he knows that Ploni Amoni isn't going to want to marry Ruth, right? If that's his expectation, he should have led with that. He didn't need to start with the field, which is like you're trying to lure him in order to get him to say no. Unless the answer is he doesn't know he's going to say no. Boaz thinks maybe I won't end up marrying her. Maybe he'll marry her. And he's trying to sweeten the deal first with the field and then lure him in, and it just doesn't work. It's very unclear. Janine.
I was wondering, did Boaz want specifically to marry, that he himself should marry?
So it's funny. I would have assumed so. But the truth of the matter is maybe not.
Maybe he's giving Ploni Amoni a chance to show that he's a good guy. And then he was ready to come to rescue when it came to money. So he won't feel guilty about saying, wait, I don't want to marry her. It's too complicated. But he's giving him a more pleasant way out.
Well, the pleasant way out,
I'll give my money. I'll help her. Oh, and then when it comes to the next step, marrying her, he already showed his goodwill.
It just seems a lot less pleasant to me this way. It would have been more pleasant if you didn't get him to say, yes, I want to buy the field, and then walk away when it finds out it's marrying Ruth. Like, this makes it very obvious that his concern is Ruth. I would have preferred that he just walk in with the Ruth thing and let him say, you know what, today's not a good day for me. Now he's really made himself look bad. I don't know. Ricky, and then Rose, and then I'm going to go into the questions as I see them. Yes, Ricky.
First of all, he probably knows Ploni Amoni, and he might know that the man is kind of greedy. So that's why he leads with the field. And the other thing, he's kind of obligated to go to Ploni Amoni because he's the first one. Boaz is only the second one, so he's obligated to go. And maybe, as I said, maybe he knows that Ploni Amoni is just a greedy guy, and he'll go for the field, and he'll throw in the girl, too.
So he definitely knows that Ploni Amoni is going to want the field. Let me go back a step. He definitely has to go to Ploni Amoni first. He's not allowed to subvert the order. That's very clear. Is it possible that he really wanted Ploni Amoni to do this and he thought he was luring him in? Yeah, that could be. We don't know that Ploni Amoni is greedy yet. We haven't seen anything to prove that at all. So I'm not so sure I would go there. I'm going to take Rose's question, and then I'm going to go further with this. Yeah.
So I just want to suggest that perhaps he actually really, really wants to marry Ruth. That's in his head. That's what he wants. The land is secondary. But then he has to go about it in a fashion that he thinks he can trap Ploni Amoni. And he says, well, he'll say about the land, and then he'll mention Ruth because he'll know that he really doesn't want Ruth. Ploni Amoni doesn't want Ruth. So in other words, he started with, because he himself, Boaz himself wants Ruth.
But if Boaz really wants this, then he's doing it the wrong way. Because the pill that's harder to swallow is marrying Ruth, not buying the field. He should have led with that instead of getting him to agree to the field and then presenting. You know, if you want a poison pill, you put the poison pill first, right up front. It's such a strange thing. Maybe the answer really is that he's trying to get Ploni Amoni to do it, that he doesn't really care. Maybe that was Dr. Ziegler's point, because she believes that Boaz loved Ruth. Boaz is just trying to fulfill his obligations. And so whether he fulfills the obligation or somebody else does, the job gets done. So maybe that's one way to look at it. But I'm going to go further. I know different people have had comments, but I'm going to go further with it because I want to make sure that we cover this properly today. So the first question that we need to address is the question of how did Naomi get a field in the first place? This is Elimelech's field, right? That's what the text says. The field of our brother Elimelech. How in the world did Naomi get Elimelech's field? That's not the way inheritance works. Inheritance in Jewish law says that if a man passes away and he doesn't have descendants who inherit from him, then the inheritance goes back up the family line, the male family line. He doesn't have sons. He doesn't have daughters, right? So it goes to his brothers. It goes to his father. It doesn't go to his wife. A woman does not inherit from her husband in Jewish law. What a woman gets is something else. What is it that a woman gets in Jewish law? She gets the ksuba. Right? She gets the ksuba, she gets support. There are all sorts of payments. It's not an inheritance. So how does she get it? Two different approaches. One approach, I think this is the message of the Gemara in Bava Basra in source number one. The Gemara in Bava Basra, which we've read before, talks about the relationships in that family of Elimelech, and it tells us Elimelech, Salmon, Ploni Amoni, and the father of Naomi, Kulan bnei Nachshon ben Aminadav Heim, they're all sons of Nachshon. In other words, Naomi's father is Elimelech's brother. Naomi married her uncle. That's not so strange. That happens all the time in Tanakh and in the Gemara. The idea of marrying one's uncle was something of a tradition. So it could be that since her father marries, since she married Elimelech, maybe Elimelech's field went through her father to her. That's what she inherited. Because when Elimelech dies without heirs, without descendants, I should say, it goes to his brothers. So that may be what's going on. There's an advantage to saying that. If you jump ahead to sentence 9, you find out that in doing this redemption process, Boaz not only gets Elimelech's field, not only does he get Mahlon's field, he also gets somebody else's field. You see that? He gets Kilion's field. Where in the world has Kilion's field been? Why does he get Kilion's field? Unless the answer is that Kilion's field goes back up through the family tree, and Naomi, again, is an heir. And therefore, Naomi has the field. That's all one way to read it.
Where else would Kilion's field go?
Well, Kilion's field really should be absorbed in the family plot. But it shouldn't be going to Naomi. Again, unless Naomi is an heir. That's the problem.
But that also would be a form of going up.
But only if she is a relative through by being the daughter of Kilion's uncle. It wouldn't come from being married to Elimelech. That's my point. The other way to read it, which does not address the Kilion problem, is the Malbim's approach in source number 2. And the Malbim here says what I already mentioned in the beginning, that it's not that Naomi sold off a field when they arrived in town and now you want to redeem it. That can't be, because then it couldn't be redeemed until 2 years elapse. The Malbim also notes that it doesn't work because the text is going to say you acquire it from the hand of Naomi, not from the hand of whoever she sold it to. But continuing, in the middle of the second line in the Malbim, at the ellipsis, if you're following the English, you want the beginning of the fourth line. He points out that the text says, describing this piece of land, Chelkat HaSadeh. Chelkat HaSadeh can just mean the lot. But that's not the way Malbim takes it. He says, V'hine mima shekatav chelkat hasadeh, mashma rak chelek min hasadeh velo kula. The term chelkat hasadeh means only part of the field, not the whole field. Then he quotes you Ibn Ezra, who says, yeah, because Elimelech didn't have a complete field. He does not like that idea. He says, that's not true. So what is it? After the brackets, ki achar shemesu ha'av u'banav, Lakha Naomi chelek min hasadeh b'ksuvasa. The answer is that Elimelech dies, Ruth is entitled to claim the ksuba, or just have support for now. She's just getting support. Then Mahlon and Kilion die, and after that, she gets the estate, I guess as well solved for Kilion also, she gets the estate as part of payment of her ksuba, the Gam Rut not lachelek b'ktuvata, and Rut also took part of this land for her ksuba. So in other words, chelkat hasadeh means the part of the land that Naomi got for her ksuba from Elimelech, and the part of the land that Ruth got for her ksuba from Mahlon. Now you'll tell me, but wait a minute, Ruth wasn't Jewish when she married Mahlon. ksuba was not a uniquely Jewish thing. The concept of ksuba is, there's a lot of discussion as to whether ksuba is biblical or rabbinic. From a Jewish law perspective, we generally assume that ksuba is rabbinic. There is a view, though, that a very strong view in the Gemara, that it's actually biblical. However you say it, though, whether you say ksuba is biblical or rabbinic, it's clear in the text of the Torah, when it uses the term mohar habitulot, that there was a payment called mohar, which went with marriage, payable at the time of the marriage, or it could be pushed off until the end of the marriage, and that was cultural, that wasn't Jewish specific, and the evidence for that is found in the Islamic world today. Because in the Islamic world, there is a payment called mohar, which is analogous to the ksuba payment. So the point is that Ruth is getting a ksuba, Naomi is getting a ksuba, and the deal is, as Malbim concludes, Boaz says to Ploni Almoni, there's this field of Naomi. She wants to sell her half field out of Elimelech's field, and that's what you are redeeming. That's the initial part of the conversation, is you're getting Naomi's part of the field. Is that clear? I just want to make sure that's clear before I call on Moish. The idea is either Naomi has land because of her father being part of the family with Elimelech, or Naomi and Ruth both got land for their ksuba, and Naomi's field is what Boaz is talking about right now. Yes, Moish.
Okay, I'm totally showing my ignorance, but cannot a father settle property, let's say land, upon a daughter when she gets married and she has certain, perhaps not all rights. I think she owns the property, only the husband gets the fruit of it, or vice versa.
So there is a possibility for the father, or any man, frankly, to give her a piece of land that becomes her property. That's entirely possible. The weakness here is just that the way it's described in the text is Elimelech's field.
Yeah, but there's one beautiful thing. She says, when she comes back from Moab, she says, Ani Mele'ah Yatsati.
Yeah.
I know that could talk about kids, but it could also mean, I was a wealthy woman.
And she was a wealthy woman. She was part of a wealthy family. Whether she had independently held property, which her husband can give her or not, who can say? Susan. Okay.
Sort of what I'm concerned, because we keep saying he's rich. Then we see her coming back and begging for the food.
Correct.
Call it, not begging, but I don't know what the right word is.
A field is an asset that you can't really use unless you have manpower. And manpower specifically back in those days, for sure.
But to be rich, you still have it. Like you said, she couldn't sell it. Because of the 2-year thing, but she could have said, look, I'll just take the money and
She could have, sold it when she came back. She didn't, but she could have sold it at that point.
So, I just don't understand why they would do this, be poor, do this, having to go to, and this hard work that we said that was at least fields.
Right.
When there was assets.
So I go back to what we said, right, so I go back to what we said a few weeks back, which is her plan has been to have Ruth get redeemed. She doesn't want to sell off the field. She wants to have Ruth get redeemed. She's just waiting until the end of the harvest season, hoping Boaz is going to move on this. Boaz doesn't move on it, and then she makes the pitch. But she'd rather not to sell off ancestral land. Selling off ancestral land was a horrible thing to have to do.
But could it also be that, from what we're saying, even going to pick, she wanted, if not Boaz, she wanted Ruth married. So that's why she had to get Ruth out there.
I don't know.
You're saying she picked Boaz, but she didn't, because Ruth didn't go to Boaz's field.
Right, but she was going to... No, because if Ruth... This goes back to what we said a couple of weeks ago. If Ruth doesn't go to Boaz's field, then she ends up approaching Ploni Almoni. That's all. She just didn't need to, because Ruth ended up with Boaz, and they had a relationship, and so forth. Okay, so that's number one. Number one is, there is a field. It is in the possession of Naomi, or in the possession of Naomi and Ruth, as Malbim reads it. And and it is put out there for the Redeemer, and the Redeemer says, sure, I'll be a fine, upstanding guy, I'm going to pay for the field. Then he finds out he has to marry Ruth, and he says, no, that'll ruin my portion. How is it going to ruin your portion, pal? What are you worried about? So, a Medrash picks up on the fact that it says, Hamoaviah, the Moabite. Take a look at source number 3 on the sheet. His concern was, Shalo lifgom et banav. He did not want to create a defect, a flaw, in his kids. Kasavurshi asuralo, because he thought she's prohibited. What are you telling me? I should marry a Moabite. You're not allowed to marry a Moabite. So that's why he backs off. And that's why, if you look carefully at the sentence, if you look at sentence 6, he says twice, lo uchal ligol, I cannot redeem. I can't redeem, it would ruin my portion, you redeem, because I cannot redeem. Why does he say this twice? So, says the Medrash, number 1 was about lineage. He's worried about what's going to happen to his kids if he marries a Moabite. And number 2, he was already married. His wife is not thrilled with this idea. He doesn't want to upset his wife, which makes him kind of sweet, you know. That's his consideration here. So, similar note in Malbim, he doesn't want to mess around with this whole Moabite thing. Yes, Gita.
You've not explained why he automatically loses his portion.
We didn't say he loses his portion. This, according to this view, his only problem is he doesn't want to bring a Moabite into the family.
But doesn't he say, I'll lose my inheritance?
He says, I will ruin my inheritance. And it's not inheritance. I'll ruin my portion.
What does that mean?
It means that everyone's going to identify me as the guy who married a Moabite, and my kids as the kids from a family that a Moabite married into.
Okay.
That's the way this Medrash reads it, picking up on the use of the term Moaviyah. Ibn Ezra says that's not the concern. And frankly, it makes a lot of sense to say what Ibn Ezra says. The big problem with saying that his concern is that she's a Moabite is that Boaz is the one orchestrating the marriage. Right? Boaz is the one telling you this is okay. So you have a pretty good stamp. Ibn Ezra says that's not what's going on. If you take a look at source number 4, Penashchiz is nachalasi. I'm worried about ruining my portion. Haisalo nachala rabah. He had a lot of land. What's the problem, asks Gita. So you had a lot of land? Because he also has kids. And if he has kids from Ruth also, then those kids are going to split up the land. He's adding heirs to the family. That's what he doesn't want to do. Or, alternatively, once again, Yesh Omrim Remez Al Ishto, like in the Medrash, maybe it's about his wife not being so happy that he's suddenly polygamous. That might be offensive to her. Okay. So we have him refusing, whether because she's a Moabite, whether because he doesn't want to dilute what his kids are inheriting, whether because his wife is not going to be happy when he brings home Ruth. But that brings the big question. And the big question is, I already mentioned it in the beginning, why should buying the field require that he marry Ruth? Where did that come from? Why is that true? And if it is true, why didn't Ploni Almoni know it from the beginning? Right? Why does he need this whole conversation? We discussed this briefly back in chapter 3, but I'm recapping it now where it's relevant here. We discussed briefly in chapter 3 the whole concept of Yibum and Ge'ulah and why you do that marriage. But I want to bring this all together here. The first approach to why these two things are linked is that it's Ruth's decision. We don't actually know when Boaz asked Ruth this question, whether Boaz is just putting words in Ruth's mouth. But take a look at Rashi in source number 5. When the text says that you're going to have to also marry Ruth, Rashi comments, Atat Sarich Liknot, you have to transact with her. V'hi eina mitratza elem kein tisa'ena. She ain't interested unless you marry her. So Ruth is the one who is stipulating marriage is part of this deal. That also fits with a comment that Rashi made in chapter 3, sentence 9, when we were talking about the idea that the name of the deceased remains with the field. Ruth's vision of how Yibum would work is presented in source number 6. I'm reading out my English translation in the interests of time. My mother-in-law and I need to sell our portion, and it is upon you to purchase it. Transact with me. This is Ruth talking. Ruth talking to Boaz at that point. Transact with me along with it, so that the name of the deceased will be mentioned with his portion. When I come to the field, they will say, this is Mahlon's wife. So it was Ruth who wanted this to be done. Ruth who presented it to Boaz initially in chapter 3, and Boaz is turning around and handing it as a requirement to Ploni Almoni, which explains why Ploni Almoni was taken by surprise. There is no law that says that in order to buy the field, you have to marry Ruth. Ruth is driving a hard bargain. Ploni Almoni is completely taken by surprise. He thought he was just buying a field, and now he finds out, no, there's actually a marriage here too. And he's like, wait, we don't have a videographer. I'm not interested in doing this yet. That's approach number one. Approach number two goes back to what we said when we talked about Yibum and the idea of associating the deceased with the field. We brought from Professor Meltzer, if you take a look at source number 7 on your sheet, I brought it back here, we'll read my English translation. He says in his introduction to the book of Ruth, the general principle is that the Torah intends that every Jewish man possess a portion in the land. A portion he received in inheritance from his fathers and ancestors going back to the generation that settled the land in the time of Yehoshua. And this portion passes via inheritance to his sons and grandsons, generation to generation, to the end of all generations. Each individual is a stranger and settler in his portion. But the portion which passes from generation to generation maintains the name of the one who holds it forever. Your name is forever with your land. Therefore, it is a great benefit to the deceased who bequeaths his portion to his son after him, for thus the name of the deceased is upheld upon his portion in the midst of Israel. And therefore, it is a great sin to sell the portion of one's ancestors to an outsider. So the idea is, keep the family name alive and the name of each member of the family alive in this line of inheritance. And so, in order to do that, you need to have Mahlon involved, right? If Ploni Almoni just redeems the field by buying it, and Ruth is not associated with it, then Mahlon's name disappears. So that's why you also have to marry Ruth, and that way Mahlon's name remains with the field. This is difficult, because then I don't really know why the Redeemer didn't know that in the first place. Nonetheless, that's a second approach. But I'm going to take a third approach, and this is what I suggested back in chapter 3, now becomes relevant here, which is, it may be true that the core form of Yibum was about maintaining the name of the deceased. But without question, what's going on here is also an attempt to support Ruth. Having nothing to do with the business of reincarnation of the deceased, having nothing to do with keeping his name on the land, it's meant to help Ruth. We saw that in the text, right? Go back to chapter 3, sentence 1, when Naomi introduced the idea, Naomi said, Avakesh lach manoach asher yitav lach. I'm going to find a place that's going to be good for you to rest, to be supported. And that's why in chapter 3, sentence 9, Ruth says to Boaz, spread your cloak over your maidservant, ki go'el ata, because you are the Redeemer. You're going to be taking care of me, not just taking care of Mahlon. And that, I think, is what Ploni Almoni doesn't understand and where he makes his mistake. He thinks this is just about Mahlon. This is just about something for him. Keep his name with the field, maybe like Professor Meltzer. That's what he is agreeing to. And then he realizes he made a mistake. It's about taking care of Ruth long term, and that he's not willing to do. That's the idea. Now that matters a great deal as we move into our next big question, which is, why is this guy named Ploni Almoni? Why in the world would I name him Ploni Almoni? So I want to show you some outlier views before we get to the main one. Yes, Ricky.
Why does she go directly to Boaz? Doesn't she know that Tony Almoni is...
Yeah, so we dealt with this a few weeks ago, and we said it's either because Boaz has a big name in the city, he's somebody of standing, or because she already has a relationship with him now through the field. So there are some outlier views about why he's named Ploni Almoni. Take a look at source number 9 on the sheet, please. This is from the Medrash in Rut Rabbah. Rabbi Yoshua Omer Ploni Almoni Shemo. That was actually his name. You know, some people luck out and their name is David, and some people, you know, their parents had a different thought at the time and they got named Ploni Almoni. It's just the way it goes. The terrible thing on the schoolyard, that's for sure. But that's Rabbi Yeshua's very interesting approach to it. A second idea is found in the same medrash. Rabbi Shmuel Bar Nachman says, Ilaim haya midivrei Torah. Almoni comes from the word ilaim, which means to be mute. He was mute in his knowledge of Torah. What does that mean? As the Medrash goes on to say, he said, Mahlon and Kilion married Moabites and they died. I should now endanger myself, endanger my kids? I don't want to do that. He was mute in Torah. He didn't know that actually it's fine to marry her. He wasn't aware of this halacha that Amoni v'lo Amonit, Moavi v'lo Moabit. So he was mute from Torah. He didn't know it was allowed. That's a second approach in this Medrash. The Malbim offers us another idea. Take a look at source number 10. He says the word almoni is like the word aluma. We talked about sheaves out in the field, right? You had the shibolim that were the stalks, and then you had the alumot, or alumim in some cases, which are sheaves, the stalks that are bound together, like with Yosef, ma'alumim, alumim, besoch ha-sadeh. So the Malbim says, almoni means tying things together, binding things together. He has a bind with this family because he is supposed to redeem. As for the word ploni, ploni is from the word pele, which means to clarify something. Like when a person takes a vow in the Torah, it's ki yafli lindor neder. So Malbim, who is normally a pretty strict grammarian, it really seems to be reaching with this one. Ploni almoni, the one who will make clear his bond. So that's what we decided to call him in this text. Overwhelmingly, despite these different explanations, the general view is no. Ploni almoni means John Doe. Anonymous. We don't know who he is. So take a look, please, at source number 11. Take a look at source number 11, where you will see why we say that. The term Ploni Almoni is not unique to the book of Ruth. In the book of Shmuel, Shmuel Aleph, this is coming up for those in my Thursday afternoon shiur. You'll have to remember this because we're going to finish chapter 20 this week, and then it's on to 21. So this is when David runs away to the city of Nov, when he's on the run from Shaul. And he tells them, I'm on a mission from Shaul. Vayomer David la'achimelech ha-kohen. David says to Achimelech, the priest, Hamelech tzivani davar. The king has sent me on a mission. Vayomer elai, he told me, Ish al yedam me'uma, es ha-davar asher anochi sholach ha-cho v'asher tzivisicho. Nobody can know what this mission is. I'm on a secret mission. And I have sent the youths off to a place that shall not be named.
Okay, but this is after Rut. So the name Ploni Almoni became John Doe.
And the answer is, we don't have any way to prove anything. The only thing we're seeing is that Shmuel, author of Ruth, uses the term Ploni Almoni here, and uses the term Ploni Almoni there, and there he's clearly using it to mean something anonymous. Here too, it means something anonymous. Ricky, I'm sorry, but it's 2:14. I gotta get moving here.
But quickly, but is it a difference between when you say Yemach Shmo, say his name was...
We didn't get to explanations yet. Hang in there. The second source that I bring you here in source number 11, the other place where Ploni Almoni is used, we learn in Melachim Bet, Umelech Aram haya nilcham b'Yisrael, the king of Aram was fighting against Israel, Vayiva'atz el avadav lemor el mekom ploni tachanosi. And he says to his servants, he says, I'm camping in such and such a place. And then Yish Elokim, the man of God, the prophet, sends a message saying, be careful, don't go to that place, because that's where Aram is camping. But it's an unnamed place. The idea is no name. So that Ploni Almoni is taken to mean he who must not be named. Susan, I saw your hand before. Is it a necessity for now, or it can wait? Okay, thank you. So that's the way we look at it. We use the term that way. We use the term Ploni over and over and over again in rabbinic literature. We use the term Plon when we want to refer to a place that is unnamed in rabbinic literature. There are all sorts of attempts to try to trace this etymologically. I brought you Rashi Ralbag. Rashi Ralbag Ibn Ezra offer you the idea that it's connected to Pele, meaning something that is covered and hidden, that is beyond comprehension, like Nifla, like Pilei Plaim. Almoni is like Almana, a widow, because the widow doesn't have a name. Ralbag also has Elaim as some kind of hiddenness, and he plays with the Ayin Elem, and I'm not going into all of the etymology here, because honestly, I find it difficult to take any of it seriously as pure etymology. I think Ploni Almoni was just what people said when they wanted to say this is something anonymous. I don't think you need to find an etymology for it. The issue here is what Ricky wanted to go towards, which is, why are we making him anonymous? Right? Why do people end up anonymous in Tanakh?
Not to embarrass him, I would think. He's done something wrong. It says, Al tabin abnei chavircha, it's mirabim, and maybe by publicly, he was worried about his descendants, so maybe by publicly disparaging him, it wouldn't be right.
So that's a fascinating idea. I wish that were true.
But it's also...
Meaning, no, what I mean by that, when I say I wish that were true, is that if Tanakh really cared about not embarrassing people for bad behavior, we would have a lot of Ploni Almonis running around Tanakh. I feel like that's not a concern of theirs. So tell me, why do people get anonymous in Tanakh?
I think it's because they don't matter in terms of the moral ethic being told.
So maybe it's that they don't matter. Their name doesn't matter, or they don't matter. Maybe you can say that. So I gave you some examples in source number 14 on the sheet. Afterwards, I'll give you my other line after the recording is off. I have another answer, but that's not for the recording. Get in trouble. But if you look at the examples in source number 14, examples of people who are anonymous. So in the beginning of the Chumash, we're told that Adam and Chava have Cain, Hevel, Sheit, and then Vayolet, Banim, Uvanot, and they had more kids. What are their names? No idea whatsoever. There were more sons and daughters. Fine. That's an example of anonymity, and I think that's a case where, like Toby said, their role is just not significant. In that case, they're going to disappear with the flood. Their role really isn't significant. Sometimes that's what's going on. However, that's not always true. When Avram sends his servant to go get a wife for Yitzchak, the servant matters a great deal. It could be Eliezer, but the text for some reason forgets his name. It just calls him Eved Avram, servant of Avram, perhaps because his role in the story is being emphasized by naming him for what he is doing, which is he is Avraham's agent in this to get a wife for Yitzchak. He doesn't have his own identity. Similarly, Elisha, at one point in the book of Malachim, is just called Isha Elokim. that passage that we just read. He's the Ish Elokim who is alerting them to the ambush of Aram. He's just called Ish Elokim. That's all that we're going to identify him as. So that's another possibility. I gave you another reference from Parshas Baaloscha when they choose 70 elders to support Moshe. He gathered 70 men from the elders of the nation, but it doesn't say what their names were. The only two we know about are the ones who weren't in the 70, Eldad Umedad. We don't know about the others. Why are we not told about them? Why don't we get their names? I suspect because giving them names would take away from their communal role. The whole point is their identity as the body of 70 elders. They're not supposed to all have their own names and their own identities. Then you have the three men who show up at Avraham's tent. They don't get names, right? Like the man who fights with Yaakov at night. We don't get a name. Why don't we get a name for them? Why don't we get names for them?
Because they're angels.
Are they angels? Maybe. I mean, it's unclear who knows what at which point, and certainly with the one who fights.
Three men that come to Abraham.
I would say we keep them anonymous because their identity is a mystery. The whole point is to keep them mysterious. That's the idea. Chana, you're still muted. What?
Actually, the one with Yaakov says, "Why do you ask my name?"
Vehupeli, correct. Correct. If you look in the beginning of Parsha Shmos, we're told a man went from the house of Levi and he took a daughter of Levi, and of course we know who they were, Amram and Yocheved, but we're not given their names. Why? In order to project an everyman sensibility, like anybody can do this. All sorts of nice Divrei Torah build on that idea. And then the last example I gave in number 14, and his name shall be called in Israel the house of the one whose shoe was removed. The case of the man who doesn't do Yibum will not redeem, and there it's clearly meant to degrade him. It's meant to take away his status by removing his name. So what's going on here? Is he a mystery man? Is that why we're leaving him anonymous? So the commentators here all zero in on one reason for why he is anonymous. If you take a look at source number 15, you see it in Rashi. V'lo nichtav shemo, his name is not recorded, lafi shelo ava ligol. You don't want to redeem. You don't get your name there. Like Beit Chalutz Hana'a, like the fellow who won't do Yibum. He doesn't deserve it. Although we still need to ask, well, why does that involve marrying Ruth? Now we've addressed that. I would add more to the same point, and Dr. Ziegler makes this point as well, is that he refuses to help because he doesn't want to ruin his own nachala, his own name. You are concerned more about your name than about somebody else's welfare. Measure for measure, you don't get your name. You follow? That's another dimension to it. But I would go even further, and this takes us back to the way we started the book. It's too bad this isn't the last one in the series on Ruth, because it would be a nice way to wrap it up. He's working against the narrative of the entire book. First of all, he's against our happy ending, right? The redemption of Ruth, right? Remember, Ruth praised Boaz back in chapter 2 for restoring her name, Lahakireni. This man who shall not be named, Ploni Amoni. Back in chapter 2, Ruth praised Boaz for restoring her name. This man refuses to recognize Ruth. In this chapter right here, we're talking about restoring the name of Mahlon. There will be more names in this chapter, the name of the son, other names as well, but just restoring the name of Mahlon. He's refusing. He doesn't want to restore the name of Mahlon. The idea of restoring the name is central here. We spend verse after verse here talking about the kinyan, the transaction that's involved. Even more than that, though, Ploni Almoni is the villain acting against the messages we identified at the start of the book. Right? We asked, why is this book here? What is the point of the book? So one answer we gave was to validate King David's lineage, which this fellow refuses to perpetuate. He doesn't know, but that's what he's doing. Another explanation was not just perpetuating the lineage, validating the lineage of King David, but also the idea of David coming from chesed, coming from kindness that Dr. Ziegler had emphasized, which again, he won't engage in. Or the idea in the Medrash that this book was written in order to show that God rewards kindness. He is not engaging in kindness, and he is not rewarding the kindness of Ruth. Or the idea that I had presented, that this book is about loyalty and betrayal, he is way on the wrong side of the ledger in that regard. So it makes sense. This book is not going to reward this fellow Ploni Almoni. It is not going to record his name because he is acting against the whole point of the book. The book is supposed to give me something which he is operating against, so we take his name out. That's the idea. And here I point you to source number 16 from Dr. Ziegler, which I think enhances this idea. She writes, and I'll go with my English translation here in the interests of time. The Redeemer's public refusal could have birthed disaster for Ruth. Right? When he says, I'm not going to marry her, regardless of his reason. Until that time, the only public declaration regarding Ruth was Boaz's sweeping support for her deeds back in chapter 2 when he said, everybody knows you're an Eshes Chayil, right? He had these nice things to say. Actually, Eshes Chayil was in chapter 3. But in chapter 2, he said, everybody knows you've done such wonderful things for Naomi. Presumably, the impact of these words on the local population brought about a meaningful improvement in Ruth's social standing. I don't know if that's true or not, but that's her assumption. But marrying Ruth would be far more personal than to simply bless her, right? Saying, you seem like a nice girl, is not nearly the same as marrying her. The public and troubled refusal of the Redeemer to marry Ruth could have meaningful ramifications for Ruth's social status and future. Boaz decided differently from the Redeemer. Similar to the way that Orpah's pedestrian conduct emphasized the unique character of Ruth, right? Orpah isn't a bad person. Orpah's acting normally. But that is a foil. It highlights the greatness of Ruth. The Redeemer's selfish concerns also served as a foil so that the reader could internalize the amazing selflessness of Boaz. Unlike the Redeemer, the noble decision of Boaz to fulfill the Yibumesk, that's not Dr. Ziegler's word, that one's mine. My spell check doesn't like it. To fulfill the Yibumesk custom and marry Ruth sprang from a deep feeling of responsibility. So, in other words, the point that she's making, which I think fits in very well, is that Ploni Almoni is a foil for Boaz, a contrast which demonstrates his great traits. We don't name the foil in this book. His name is blotted out of it. That phrase seems very strong. Ricky used the phrase Yimach Shemo. And that's a very strong phrase that we reserve for the worst of the worst. So I'm not going quite as far, but that's really what we're doing, is saying he doesn't serve the ends and the mission of this book. His name is gone. That's the idea that I wanted to get to, showing you how his mission is supposed to be redeeming the field, marrying Ruth, taking care of Ruth as part of the Yibum or Ge'ulah or whatever we want to call it. And that's what this man is working against. He's inconsistent with the book. He's out of touch. We take him out. What I still want to do, as I said in the beginning, is record a session sometime next week and send out the link so you can catch the recording of it, talking about the blessings of the second part of this chapter, some of the ins and outs of them, the naming of Oved. That I will be doing, God willing, next week before we come back for a week about Echa. I'll take questions and comments for a few minutes. But, yeah.
Before you take questions, if some people will leave, and because even though I hope everyone will rejoin us for Echa, this is kind of the last time we'll be together as a class. I'd like to take the opportunity to thank you. I'm sure I speak for everybody in thanking Rabbi Rechiner for his remarkable classes, for his teaching. I'll speak for myself and probably for everybody in saying that we are always amazed at the his preparation, his breadth of his knowledge, whether it be for this class, for the multiple classes and the multiple different topics that he delves into with such remarkable knowledge, expertise,
thank you,
and insight.
Enough for me.
And so thank you very much. And we look
Thank you.
And because of that, we all know how important the institution that he represents, the Kolo, is in our community, the important role it plays in the community. And so I speak for all of us. I speak for myself, and I encourage everyone to continually support it. You support it when you pay your tuition here at Sumiko Road, but you also, we all should support it to the best of our ability.
Thank you. I appreciate the second part. I appreciate. Thank you very much.
You made it through, Rabbi Torochino. You made it through the first part.
I like being able to turn off video. I'm going to stay on Zoom just for that.
I want to hear what's for the next week.
Sorry?
So we're going to skip 1 week, and then we're going to carry on?
We'll have 1 week on Eichon, 1 week of Eichon on July 6th, yes.
And what were you planning to say after the recording?
Yeah, that's what
I want. So, yeah, so